Good morning, and welcome to the April edition of Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. Today's guest is a Jungian analyst and director of the C.G. Jung Institute Center in Houston, Texas. His books include The Middle Passage, From Misery to Meaning in Midlife, and Swamplands of the Soul, New Life in Dismal Places, both part of a series, including the book we're going to focus on today, The Eden Project, In Search of the Magical Other. He has also authored Under Saturn's Shadow, The Wounding and Healing of Men. All of these books are published by Inner City Books of Toronto. In The Eden Project, Hollis touches on such sensitive topics as how our search for love in another human being has replaced our search for God, how early psychic programming is difficult to reflect upon until we reach midlife, and that we cannot achieve a higher or better relationship with the divine, or as he calls it, the other, than we have achieved with ourselves. I'd like to welcome Dr. Hollis to our show today by asking him to explain why he named his book as he did, including what the desire to return home is about. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you very much, Bella. The Eden Project is a kind of grandiose title to suggest that there's a very large amount of energy that's expended around the subject of relationships. I've had the privilege of traveling a great deal and speaking to various groups, and invariably the questioning of the groups, no matter what our announced topic is, comes around the relationships. And so one could say, well, of course, that's because relationships are so important. And then we'd have to ask the question, but why is it that relationships are so important? And what is it that what role are they playing in our psychological reality? And so as I began to think about it, it occurred to me that our life's journey begins with the loss of a relationship, when we're sort of violently expelled from a primal connection to nature and to the universe through our mother's womb, and it ends with a kind of cessation of our connection to relationships in this world through mortality. And so we see that in a certain way there's a kind of archetypal dilemma here. I mean by that, but it's more than just the story of the individual. It's the story of our species. It's the story of this primal sense of disconnect and search for a reconnection in life. And that experience of connection and disconnect is found in the stories and traditions of all peoples in all times, in all places. And in the Western tradition, in many ways, it was depicted dramatically in the notion of the original sense of connection in the Eden state, and then the disconnect and the loss of relationship that occurred there. So I thought of that title, The Eden Project, as a kind of metaphor for this very deep sense of separation that we all carry, and on the other hand, a deep urge for a reconnection as well.
Yes, unfortunately, I didn't have time to finish your other book, The Middle Passage, From Misery to Meaning in Midlife. I wish I had, simply because you state how important it is that we, at midlife, start doing that reflective work, or really are almost unable to do it before then. Can you expand on that a bit?
Well, I think each of us as a child is impressed with one central fact, and we all got the same message. And that is, the world's big and you're not, and the world's powerful and you're not. Now just spend the next few decades of your life dealing with that.
Yeah.
So every child, of course, has to make certain adaptations based on his or her perceptions about what the world's about. And we often tend to internalize those perceptions and the little strategies that we work out to meet our needs, or even in some cases to survive. And it becomes, in time, a kind of provisional identity, a set of behaviors, attitudes towards ourselves and others, and sort of emotional reflexes designed to manage the level of existential anxiety that we may feel at any moment, get our needs met, and create some kind of rapprochement with the others in our life. And these things get reinforced, of course, by education and religion and popular culture. And by the time we leave our parents' home, we walk out into the world as a kind of assemblage of these behaviors and attitudes. And because we have big bodies and maybe big roles to play in life, we think we are ourselves, we think we're adult, we think we're conscious. And typically, a few years down the line, we began to realize that the only person who's been consistently present in all the scenes of our lives has been ourselves, and however much we might wish to shift responsibility from ourselves to someone else, we begin to realize, well, you know, there's something here going on within myself that's creating the world around me. And I think it typically takes 3 or 4 decades for a person to really come to that point. And there are two reasons for that. One, we have to develop enough sense of conscious identity, what we might call a sense of personal ego state, to be able to look at our lives in a way that a child cannot separate from his or her life and really reflect upon it. And secondly, we have to have created patterns. And they're not necessarily the patterns that we sought to create, but the patterns show up in our personal life, in our relationships, and elsewhere. And then we begin to puzzle, how is it these patterns occur in my life? And here were my intentions. How is it I wound up over in this place? And how is it there's a certain familiarity in my relational patterns? And it takes a while to achieve that kind of conscious perception, and frankly, to achieve some history that one can then begin to reflect upon.
Right.
And that's why often this doesn't really break through into consciousness until the 30s or 40s, something like that. It doesn't mean that the individual hasn't been sensitive and thoughtful along the way. It just means that the full weight of this sort of adaptive and internalized response system probably remains essentially unconscious until that time. And for some people, it may remain unconscious all their lives. So such a person would be living mostly on automatic pilot, be a set of conditioned responses. And frankly, the older I get, the more I see that so many of the things that we take for granted and assume are conscious choices are really being influenced from long ago and far away.
Amen.
Yeah.
You define soul as that energy which wants something of us, which impels us to live up to who we potentially are. This brings up two questions for me. The first is the judgment that somehow we're not perhaps worthy of the journey. I think a lot of this comes from the notion that you mentioned of original sin. Could you comment on that?
Well, I think the majority of people that I've run into don't particularly have or feel permission to be who they are. They learned that that was probably costly. The family of origin or other forces in their early life created a kind of conditional reality, and one is obliged to meet the conditions. And so I've used the word soul, which is, after all, the original meaning of the word psyche, from which we get psychology and psychiatry and psychotherapy and so forth. And the soul, as Heraclitus once said, is a distant country that we can never fully approach nor even fully explore. And what I'm trying to suggest in the recovery of psyche to psychology, or soul to the reflectivity that we bring to life, is that there's some large force, some large energy that courses through all of us that is seeking its own fulfillment. It's seeking to become in the world, and it's frequently opposed by forces in our environments, and often in time by forces within ourselves as well. So the old cliche that we become our own worst enemy, I think, proves true in so many of these different ways than we had ever thought possible.
When I interviewed Marianne Woodman a few months back, we talked about how, just exactly what you were saying about how the field of psychology has kind of become removed from the study of soul and has become more of a study of the head. Is this a kind of theory or feeling espoused by most Jungians, or is this?
Well, I think the field of modern psychology is dominated predominantly by behaviorists who work at a particular behavioral problem an individual has and seeks to correct it through some sort of conditioning process, and there's a value there. And then there's cognitive psychology that tries to identify some of the bad ideas that we're living our lives in service to, and that's useful. And of course, modern psychiatry is predominantly taken over by psychopharmacology, which is approaching the biological dimensions of our individual existence. But that whole it leaves a whole world of questions, doesn't it? It says nothing about the issue of meaning and how people feel that their lives are being lived in meaningful ways or not being lived in meaningful ways. And it says nothing about the matters of the human spirit. It says nothing about creativity versus destruction that's going on in our life. It says very little about the fact that a lot of things that many would identify as simply psychopathology often has a meaning. Our symptoms have meaning. Our depressions have meaning. The invasions that we have by what Jung called complexes have meaning. And the question is, where are these meaning questions being asked? I think they were historically asked by the great world religions, and in many such quarters they still are. And for many individuals, the traditional institutions no longer speak to them. And so the issue of meaning, the issue of spirit, the issue of creativity falls really into the unconscious and will play out through damages in relationships, bodily symptomatology, behavioral problems, addictions, and so forth. And so often the sort of armamentarium of modern psychology fractionates the individual and looks at the individual. If I said to you, well, you know, I know you now just because I know your behaviors and I know your thought processes and we know your biological processes, you would probably be offended, and rightly so, because you'd say, but you're still missing the essence of me. Mm-hmm. You're still missing something that I don't even know how to talk about, but I've always intuited as being there. I knew it as a child. I forget it from time to time. And when I do forget it, I get in trouble of one kind or another. And if I remember it, then it can lead me back to a more authentic journey.
Right. I still haven't asked you the second question about soul, but I can't help but get off on a little sidetrack. And that is, and I've asked this question of other guests, why do you feel that the current model, if you will, religious model in our Western civilization is not any longer addressing these questions that people have that are deeper?
Yeah, I can't say that they're not addressing the questions, because any individual may find very germane answers to his or her questions.
Let me just jump in and say, I guess what I mean is for a lot of people, it seems that there's many people seeking something outside of that. Sorry.
Sure, and I understand that. I just didn't want to throw the baby out with the
bathwater. I hear you.
But I think for many people, it's become a received experience passed on from someone else's experience in another time and another culture, and has not necessarily translated into the immediacy of personal experience in our own time. Because if you don't experience something to be true for you, could we really say it's true for you? If you don't experience it as somehow validating for you or connective to you or deepening your experience, how relevant is it? And therefore, I think individuals have often had to leave institutional formulations and go off and try to find something that connects for them and something that brings depth and meaning to their life, on their own terms. And many times this is a very deeply unconscious process, and that's why we have so many cultural surrogates, such as romantic love, drugs, materialism, as places where people are investing their energy in search of these connections and a deepened meaning in their life, and often feeling shortchanged as a result, because they may or may not be good places to invest that kind of energy.
Right. I want to get back to the numinous later.
Mm-hmm.
This is the second part of that question.
Okay. All right.
Can you enlarge on your idea that relationship is an arena for the enlargement of soul?
Absolutely. What is it ultimately you bring to the other person? What are they bringing to you? They're bringing who most deeply they are. Yes, a relationship is a cooperative arrangement. It could be a division of labor. It can be an economic unit. Historically, it served the maintenance of the species, the transmission of religious and cultural values, and so forth. But that's not what really we're looking for in relationship in our time. What we're looking for is some sort of meaningful engagement with the other. Now, of course, what we bring to that typically is a kind of infantilizing agenda, based on our own leftover needs, and that's another story we'll get into. But What the other most brings us, paradoxically, is the fact that they're an other. And since they are other, we are obliged somehow to enlarge, to contain our experience of them, and to incorporate aspects of their experience, and vice versa. So a healthy relationship is always going to be one in which people are continuously learning, continuously being asked to enlarge and to contain the reality of another person's experience. Now, a good example of this, and I think this is not a distraction here, Jung really developed the whole idea of personality typology, which everybody's heard of, the Myers-Briggs and introversion, extroversion, the thinking, feeling, sensation, intuitive types, and so forth. Part of the differences we bring to a relationship is that we literally experience the world differently. You look at that sphere and see an apple. I look at it and see it as an orange. Each is operating within the authenticity of our personal experience. And each of us could quickly come to the conclusion, well, you're stupid, you're pig-headed, you're deceptive, without understanding you're literally relating to a different reality. You're experiencing it in a quite different way. So if I'm going to engage you in relationship or treasure or care for you in some way, then I somehow have to enlarge my sensibility to contain aspects of your experience and vice versa. You know, there was a play that ran for 20 years on Broadway. It was a TV show, The Odd Couple. It was based on one joke, and that was, if you put two people of competing typologies in a small room, they'll soon drive each other crazy. And they did. And at the same time, that would be true of all relationships if we're not able to enlarge in some way to contain the otherness of the other. And the paradox is, it's the otherness of the other that constitutes their ultimate gift to us, because then we're caught in or engaged in a kind of developmental process rather than a regressive process. You know, the downside of the Eden Project is that we wish to go home again. We wish to have our needs met in the infantile way by the other, and that often constitutes a regressive agenda. It keeps people dependent, keeps them from developing to take care of their own needs. It often makes them angry at the other person for not meeting that hidden agenda. And as I would say, was the chief source of conflict between them. You know, why are you not meeting my agenda?
Yeah. I know some parents do this with their children, but in my experience, it just seemed a lot easier to make those connections with my kids. It wasn't quite so threatening.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow,
right.
You know?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, but even so, a child can threaten an adult's sense of reality and result in a great repression of the spirit of that child. That happens all the time.
Yeah.
The child's own natural curiosity, wonder, and developmental agenda. Because you have to remember this. Child's brought here to carry out some sort of larger project of nature or of the cosmos, not to fit into my definition of what they're supposed to be. And yet I will have a definition. And so automatically there is a conflict. And automatically that child's going to be carrying a split agenda. How do I please my father and my mother? And at the same time, how do I live my life? And the deeper the split, the more troubled the person's going to be.
Right. Well, it just seemed somehow easier as a parent, mm-hmm. who really wanted to be conscious and grow with,
sure.
her children. And my daughters are now 21, almost 22, and 19.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been a little easier to break through some of those barriers with them, to see, mm-hmm. where I've held them back and let them have their head, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's been in a more intimate relationship. I'm thinking about when Marion Woodman and I were talking, mm-hmm. about projections and how conscious relationship with a partner is about withdrawing projections.
Yes.
And you kind of take it one step further by suggesting that one of the big projections is that of transferring our desire to return home onto the other.
Yes.
Or, as you say, a fantasy that through a partner I can be healed, nurtured, protected, and spared the awful rigors of growing up.
That's right.
And, you know, it definitely, you touch a nerve in me in that sense, and I think in many others, no matter how we try and how much we're very committed to that, I think it's in my own mind, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's a little tougher when you're dealing with two adults. Maybe
so.
One wants to do it in this case, maybe the other wants to do it in that case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and in that sentence that you just quoted about the agenda we bring to the other, most of the time that's unconscious. We don't realize we're doing it.
Right.
But we begin to recognize the other is not meeting that agenda, and that becomes the source of conflict. Because if we really back up and look at the psychodynamics of relationship, we realize that they are always involving at least two fundamental psychological principles. The first is projection. Projection is an unconscious mechanism whereby I project my unconscious material onto the world around me. That's part of how we try to make the world known. If you go to a strange city, you know, you're already starting to project what you know from the past in terms of how to read traffic signs, how to navigate around that city, and so forth. And so the fact is that your history may or may not have very much to do with a new city you're visiting. Nonetheless, we're always using our own psychological history as a kind of guide to how to navigate in that new world. The other psychodynamic mechanism is transference. It comes because we are historic creatures. What we tend to do is transfer the dynamics, the scenarios, the history, the agendas from our own past onto the new situation. We do it at work as well. We expect the work world to somehow nurture us and be our family and meet our needs. We have less of an expectation, for sure, than an intimate relationship. But it works out there, too. And so people often will be chronically unhappy at work, quite apart from the work itself, but we're talking about, again, the hidden agenda. And so when we begin to look at these two essential dynamics, projection and transference, both of them have the origin where? In my unconscious. When I meet you, you're a total stranger. We've never met. We don't know anything about you. But at the same time, I begin to flood you with the material from my own history, trying to make sense of this experience, trying to sort of manage it in some way. And you're doing the same to me. And, of course, the closer we get, then the more this engages the specific dynamics of our own histories, whether we're people who tend to deal well with conflict, for example, or tolerate differences, whether our tendency in life is to approach a situation, to work with it, or to control it, as the case may be, or whether we tend to avoid it and distance ourselves. And very quickly, those dynamics will be present in any relationship. And of course, the more intimate the relationship, the more primal the material that's activated. The more it goes back to first things. The more it goes back to our first relationships. And without being reductionistic here at this point, I'd have to say that our first relationship are going to be what? With mother, with father, with other intimates in our family of origin. And so fundamental perceptions of self and world begin at that point. They're the earliest. They are the most pervasive. They occur when we are most vulnerable, most permeable, least capable of stepping outside our experience and reflecting upon it. And they often get locked into a kind of sense of self, sense of other, and how we relate to each other. Now, of course, that material gets modified over the decades by other experiences coming in, but it takes an awful lot to ever overcome the power of those primary experiences of relationship. And this is why you hear the cliches like someone wound up marrying their mother again or marrying their father. They certainly had no conscious intention to do that, but they weren't aware of the degree to which the old history was still at work. You see how people wind up realizing that unwittingly they often repeated the dynamic in their parents' marriage. See, the fantasy of the young person who leaves home is, I'm free, I'm conscious. The last thing I'm ever going to do is repeat my parents' lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, well, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, let's take a look at that and see, do you see any of those patterns there? In some cases you won't, some cases you will. And that's always experienced by us as a kind of disappointment, a defeat. Jung said once that the engagement or the encounter with the unconscious typically comes to us as a as an experience of defeat, because what's being defeated is, of course, the illusion that we know who we are, we know what's going on, and that we're in control of our lives. And if that were the case, life would be easy.
Right.
It doesn't prove to be.
Yeah, like how you write in your afterword, if all that is true, and I believe it is, the most loving thing we can do for those who we claim to love and for the world is to withdraw our projections and consciously assimilate them into our personal journey. But who wants to hear that?
Exactly.
Yes, it's you've tongue-in-cheek that a few times in your book. It's
That's
like,
right.
I know you don't want to hear this, but boy, this is meaningful stuff.
In other words, if it's not true, tell me it's not true.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The only virtue of this book is I think it's honest.
It is, absolutely. Yeah, and I definitely respect it for that.
And I don't like that myself sometimes.
I hear you on that one. Again, we're speaking today on Alternative Currents with James Hollis, author of The Eden Project, In Search of the Magical Other. This is subtitled A Jungian Perspective on Relationship, and published by Inner City Books. Jim, you say, in my personal encounters with others, I've been privileged, sometimes painfully, to grow. What about those people who want to remain alone? You do talk about this in your book, who say they're not cut out for communication, for the depth that the relationship draws them into. You had some interesting stuff to say about those who wish not to be in relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I happen to be a card-carrying introvert, as a matter of fact, even though I'm in the public world all the time. I value privacy. It energizes me. It regenerates me. And yet I realize that in the engagement with others, I'm always enlarged and brought into what we'd have to call a dialectic, you know, where one and one make three and not two. And yet there are individuals, you know, having already said I value the importance of privacy and personal development, there are individuals whose experience of intimacy was sufficiently painful. That becomes the kind of spectacles or eyeglasses through which they look at all relationships, and they're not necessarily conscious of doing it, and so it leads them to distance themselves. Because, you know, in life, when it comes to something potentially rewarding or potentially stressful, the old truism about fight or flight remains true. Either we approach the situation or we run away from it. And if the general history of the individual, or at least key traumatic points, has been sufficiently wounding to a person, then he or she will be in a distanced relationship with the world and a distanced relationship with others. In other words, people could still be married but never really be in the relationship, because intimacy is too threatening. Availability is too scary. And it's based on experiences that person has had. Now, we all have a tendency to suffer from what I might call the fallacy of overgeneralization. Simply because I've had a very painful experience in my history doesn't mean that you're going to do this or you're going to repeat that. But then, you see, for me to break the tyranny of that message that's coming to me from my unconscious, I have to take a very strong step. I have to stand right in the presence of what causes me anxiety or stress, and move closer to the possibilities with you. And that takes a lot of strength, a lot of wherewithal for a person to do it. And at its worst, you will find many times people simply not able or willing to make that effort.
But you say, if we live a solitary life, isolated from others, then in the end we can come to believe that the whole cosmos is only what we think it to be.
Yeah.
This is the universal human temptation, the timeless seduction of anthropomorphism, ethnocentrism and egocentrism. The universe extends only as far as my nose.
Yeah, yeah. In other words, for all of us, there should be times in our life where we pull away from the world and we meet ourselves. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who are running from meeting themselves and investing themselves continuously in the frenzy and chatter of others, and therefore having no relationship to the self. And yet, a relationship that excludes the other, in the end, will become kind of self-referential, what philosophy calls solipsism. You know, it's caught in a loop of its own ideas, caught in a loop of its own value system, and never it grows or enlarges. Whole cultures can do that, too.
Right.
You've seen times where cultures have withdrawn within their own value system. or subcultures, and ultimately become, you know, very rigid, fall into black and white thinking, and are incapable of growth.
And so that is a choice, I guess.
Yes.
For some. I'm going to take a break and do a station ID. You are listening to Alternative Currents on WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor, your community radio station. We are speaking today with Dr. James Hollis, author of The Eden Project, In Search of the Magical Other. We'll be back in a few. Welcome back. This is Bella Johnson, Alternative Currents, speaking today with James Hollis, author of The Eden Project, In Search of the Magical Other. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you.
You refer to addictions and have a couple of times so far in this interview, and also in the book is anxiety management techniques. You also mentioned that we long to die in the other, to be subsumed until we who would capture the object of our desire are held captive instead, which to me describes addiction pretty perfectly. Since we live in such an addictive society, I'd like it if you'd talk some about them.
Sure. First of all, I think we need to get away from some sort of judgmental tone when we talk about addictions. I think everybody has addictive patterns in his or her life. Yeah. And by addictions here, I mean reflexive responses that sort of have a life of their own. They take over whether we're aware of them or not, designed to manage the level of stress or the manage that sort of steady hum of anxiety that we often feel. And so for some people, their addictive patterns will show up in their work life. In some cases, it will be a dependence on substances. In many cases, it will be the various ways in which they try to reduce that hum of anxiety. I think, for example, one of the most widespread addictions in our time is television and the way in which people go home and sort of zone out in front of the tube there. And addictions represent efforts to make a connection. What one is always doing is overcoming the anxiety that's experienced by the disconnection of life, by that existential separation, by making a contact with the other. The other could be a person and their addictive relationships. The other could be a substance. You know, you can go to the fridge and there's something there waiting for you with no apparent demands. And it connects to you in a very primal way. And eating is, I mean, few people are neutral about eating. Either they're very positively charged for it or they have a negative charge against it for different reasons. You don't think twice about going in and filling up your car with gasoline because it just provides energy for the machine to work. And one could look at food as simply fuel for the engine. But very few people don't have some kind of valence on food, and it becomes charged. And we have the phrase comfort foods. It has to do with, again, a feeling of connection, feeling of nurturance, a kind of homecoming in a way. You know, you open the fridge, and I actually have a client in this part of the country who will get up in the middle of the night and walk through the house empty what's ever in the refrigerator and literally not remember it in the middle of the night and only see the remains in the morning. And it really has to do with a kind of desire for a primal sense of connection and nurturance. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that when the pattern takes hold, in this person's life, he's dealing with obesity as a side effect of that. And the problem is when the need and its behavior pattern has been repeated enough times, then it tends to gain a kind of autonomy in the person's life and own the person rather than the other way around.
But isn't that also symptomatic of, I mean, there really, we do live in such an addictive society. Ann Wilson Shape's book, for example, When Society Becomes an Addict, really points that out.
Yes.
Isn't it really symptomatic of the, some kind of yearning?
Yes. I think, in fact, the addictive culture is in direct proportion to the loss of the tribal mythology, you know, to the images that were once available to individuals and groups that link them to the gods, link them to nature, link them to their fellow creatures, and link them to a sense of personal identity. And you remove those images, or at least reduce their power, and a person's thrown back into what I'm calling really existential anxiety here. And our whole culture is that way.
Well, especially with the images that were fed culturally through the media.
Absolutely.
Do you think, yeah?
Well, and, you know, what we've gained is tremendous sharing of information. And that information could be useful or pernicious, as the case may be, but it doesn't necessarily connect one to anything transcendent, anything that is truly enduring in our life. And for that reason, you know, the addiction levels will continue to rise. How do people manage their anxiety? How do they manage their stress? Without the management technique beginning to have a life of its own.
Right.
It's one of the most critical problems of our whole culture, as we know.
Right.
And, of course, the alternative to an addiction would be to sit there and feel what one doesn't want to feel without doing anything to alter or correct that. And that's a very painful alternative. And so for a person to literally feel what they wish to avoid feeling, lonely, for example, or frightened, requires a significant measure of insight and strength into these situations. I think addictive patterns can be seen often even in the lifestyles and patterns that we create in daily life, so that people can really get bent out of shape if the newspaper's late in the morning or the traffic is holding them up or something like that. It extends even to trying to bring control into our lives in ways which are frankly impossible. But insofar as we think we can do it, then there's gaining a measure of control, you see, over one's the stresses. And learning to live, really, with anxiety as a aspect of our condition, as a sort of non-pathological experience of human life, I think is one of the measures of a maturing personality. I've said elsewhere, I think it was in the Swamplands of the Soul book, learning to live with anxiety, with ambivalence, and ambiguity, the triple A's, is a measure of a more and more mature personality. And the difficulty of living with anxiety produces addictions. The difficulty of living with ambivalence and ambiguity produces fundamentalisms of all kinds and bigotry and barbarism. And you can see that on national levels as well as personal levels.
Right. So you talk about that desire to be in control or kind of allude to that. And when that comes into relationship and it plays out as power struggles and fear and those kinds of things, it's almost, in essence, what you talked about is a desire to become God, to kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah, can you go into it a little bit?
Well, before moving on from the previous thought, it's, as I said, addictions are efforts to gain control. And it's interesting that the first step in the 12-step programs, no matter what, mm-hmm. what they're addressing, is the recognition that one's life is not in one's control.
Right.
In other words, that puts the fear right out there in front of you. And you can't run from it, and you have to accept it.
Yeah, I've got 12-step clients who say some people take years to take the first step.
Exactly, because it's the scariest of all.
Yeah.
And could you come back to your question again?
Sorry.
I forgot what it was.
That's okay. No, I just...
lost my mind there for a moment.
That's okay. You lost control, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I was talking about the control kind of parlaying itself into relationship where it becomes power struggles and that kind of desire to become God thing that you touched on.
Well, the first step in every relationship, as I've already said, is it begins in projection because the other is a person we don't know. We're strangers. They're strangers to us. And so we start flooding the other with our history and our material and our expectations and so forth. And then after a while, when the reality of the person sort of wears through the projection, they begin to emerge as a flawed, finite human being, just as we are, then, you know, we're struck with confusion. You know, you're not the person I thought you were, or you're not acting in this way, and so forth. And dismay, and producing initially withdrawal, and then perhaps anger, and then typically an escalation into techniques of control. And what happens then is people fall out of relatedness into, you know, the issues of the power complex at that point. In fact, Jung said once, where power prevails, love is not. I mean, there's no relationship in which there are not power issues, and power itself is not evil. Power is simply energy moving between people, but when it gets caught in complexes and these agendas, then it can be very dangerous indeed for both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a natural tendency then through sometimes overt control or sometimes passive-aggressive behavior or sometimes withdrawal as a controlling mechanism to manipulate the other person. And when that happens, the other person's defenses are bound to be activated and you're off to the races. And many times when I've seen couples in therapy, they come in after they've pretty much bloodied each other through these power complexes. And it's very hard to get people to step out from behind the wounds that have occurred or behind their defensive stratagems and begin to kind of approach the other simply as an other and to see themselves as contributory to the conflict that has come out. Because if I'm ever going to accept the fact that I've contributed to this conflict in our relationship, then I'd have to acknowledge my own agenda. I'd have to be willing to be both conscious and responsible. And not everybody's willing to do that.
Right. Well, since reflection is a big aspect to relationship, mm-hmm. and none of us likes conflict, but...
A few people do. They've learned that that's what relationship is, sadly.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, conflict is a way to grow. I mean, that whole, having something to push against.
Sure.
You say that conflict is troubling to the ego, since the ego seems to almost play the devil's advocate in helping maintain kind of this tension of opposites in our lives. How does all this make sense in light of furthering consciousness?
Yeah. Well, you know, the ego, by the ego, we're talking about not egotism or anything like that. We're talking about just who you think you are consciously, your conscious sense of who you are. Your ego's chief agenda involves its own security, its own survival, its own maintenance, and getting its needs met. That's understandable. And when we begin to deal with the reality of the world, then we have to realize, all right, I have to make some adjustments here. And that's why I was saying a maturing ego is one that learns to live with greater levels of ambiguity in life. You know, the same person I'm looking to for healing also is capable of hurting me.
Yeah.
The same person that I've invested with a kind of unconscious magic in my life is really just another wounded and struggling soul like me. And you know, while I describe it, it sounds perfectly reasonable. But when you're going through it, it's typically a disillusionment. It's a threat. It's a challenge. And the ego is really summoned to enlargement and maturation to handle that. And therefore, you know, the most loving thing we can do is sort of lift this tremendous burden off our partners, just as we should not expect our children to carry out our lives. Our children shouldn't be burdened by the notion they have to make us feel good about ourselves. Our children are here to be who they are. And I agree with you, it's often easier to free the child because we are so invested typically in their well-being as it is our partner from whom we're expecting an awful lot too.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the best things I like about your book, The Eden Project, is your list of questions that we can ask ourselves about our spiritual quest. This is page 130 for your own reference. If the central task of the first half of life is to build a solid ego identity, to leave mom and dad go into the world, what is the task of the second half of life? And this probably is addressed further in your book, The Middle Passage.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No.
I don't have the book in front of me, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
The task of the first half of life is a certain way a social task, and that is, you know, who are these people in my life called mom and dad, and how am I to deal with them, and how am I to deal with my school teacher, and what am I to learn about going into the world and creating, you know, a life out there? And if a truck runs over us at age 35, we could say, well, we did that. And if fate and nature allows us to live in the second half of life, we have to ask the question, so now what is the agenda?
Right.
And then I think the agenda has to become, and I have to put this in quotes here, a spiritual agenda, meaning by that, asking larger questions. Why am I here, really? Who am I, really? Because I can think I am simply the assemblage of all my roles. I'm my children's parent, I'm my employer's employee, etc., etc. But there's, again, that brings back the question of soul. You could say that the question of the first half of life, what does the world want of me? Question of the second half of life, what is the soul want of me?
And
different
so
agenda.
Yes, and so often I'll hear people say, well, you know, I just wish God would tell me what it is. But one thing I like about your question number two is no one else knows what is right for us, not
That's
cleric,
right.
not parent, not partner, not therapist, but something in us certainly knows and through our symptomatology expresses its dismay at our disregard. I just think that's beautiful.
Well, you know, as a therapist, sometimes people have come to me thinking I knew magical answers to what they ought to do with their life. No. What I do know is there's something in them that wants to live through them, wants to express itself in this world, and it will do so in various arenas, such as relationship, but also in the work world and the personal world and so forth. And so many times the symptomatology, whether it's a depression or a somatic illness or something like that, which most of psychology says, well, how do we get rid of that problem as quickly as possible?
Right.
How do we suppress that? The real task is to say, what's the psyche saying through this format? Why is it expressing its distress? Jung actually talked about the therapeutic power of depression. Now, how often do you hear that? The assumption always is, well, how do I get rid of my depression? Rather than ask the question, so why has the depression come to you? In other words, if what we're doing is right, and I'm not talking about a biologically based depression, that's a different animal here, and we need to be clear about that. But we're talking about a psychologically based depression, that if I'm doing the right thing for the soul, the psyche will not need to withdraw the energy. It won't revolt. If I continue to throw my energy to the places where I put it in the first half of life, I can wind up with a first-class depression, and we recognize that the psyche has acted autonomously to withdraw that energy and to say, we down here are refusing to cooperate in your placing this vital soul energy in the wrong place. So the therapeutic task, obviously, would then be to say, now, so where does the psyche want it to go? And I believe there's always an answer to that question, although it won't necessarily translate into a new job or a new relationship. That's the ego and its nervousness wanting it, you know, a report on my desk by 5 this afternoon kind of thing.
Tourniquet.
Exactly. Over time, it speaks. By the way, the word, if psyche means soul in the Greek, the word therapy comes from the Greek verb that means to listen to or to attend upon. So psychotherapy, whether it's formally seeing a therapist or doing this in one's own way, means listening to the soul or attending to the soul.
And so ideally a good therapist would help one do that for oneself.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I would hope so. And yet, generally speaking, there's very little in the training of therapists today that even raises these questions.
Mm-hmm.
That's the paradox here.
I believe you. Question three, where are we stuck in our developmental process? What fears intimidate us? Does not our tacit collusion with these fears keep us walled up in the behaviors of childhood? I think we've covered that, but go ahead if you want to expand.
No, I think that speaks for itself.
Yeah.
In other words,
yeah.
I've asked people in workshops, you know, where are you stuck in your life? And to my amusement or amazement, no one ever has asked me, what do you mean by that question? People just immediately start, it's a journaling workshop, and they immediately start writing about where they're stuck. So, you know, it stands to reason, if I know where I'm stuck, then there's an issue there for me.
Right.
Task to get unstuck. And yet, it's not that easy. If I'm stuck in a certain place, it's because it's surrounded by anxiety, even if I'm not aware of its origin. Because that means when I get near that, the defenses go up and the old behaviors kick in.
Right.
So that means to get unstuck, I'm going to have to deal with something that I have preferred to be stuck around rather than deal with in the past.
Yep.
That's, again, where the courage comes in.
Absolutely. Question four, where do we lack permission to be ourselves? Where did we lose the passion through which our nature seeks its own fullest expression? And then later down the page, whatever the fates imposed, permission, passion, programming, we are summoned to break through the old paradigms, to risk all, to be worthy of the journey to which the gods have summoned us. Again, beautifully put.
Well, I think we're here to live out something. And it's not just to be a socioeconomic unit. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty clear about that.
Yeah.
And it's not just to be our children's parents, even though I would value that above all the social roles I've ever played.
Mm.
That's part of it, but there's something larger indeed. And there's something about the bringing of the person into the world, and not in a way that's self-aggrandizing. That's in service to the old ego. I'm talking about what ultimately is a kind of service to the larger agenda of the soul. The real second half of life, I think, is about service. Service to what is worthy of your service. That's the real question.
Yeah.
What is worthy of the investment of your soul? Making another buck has proved not to be the case.
Right. Question five, how do we define, practice, integrate our spirituality? Unless our spirituality is more consciously evolved, we will lead superficial lives governed by routine, addictive behavior, or collusion with the collective. So I just really wanted to put those out on the air so people can read further in the Eden Project to expand on those. But I just think it's one of the best parts of the book, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Spirituality there really, again, has to do with what really moves you deeply and engages you deeply. And for some people, it will be working with others. For some, it's the work of their hands. For some, it's the work of their minds. For some, it's the work of creativity. It's going to vary for each of us because we're different people, different experiments.
Right. Well, we have time for one more question, and I'm going to ask it unless you've got something you want to hear. Yearning to get out.
No.
And that is about our connection with imagery. We talked about it, just touched on it briefly, but you mentioned the image is not the God, rather it is the vehicle of the godly. I really just want to get into that a little bit. The temptation exists to remain with the image rather than letting it convey us further into the mystery. How can we interact more deeply, more genuinely with the images that sustain us or feed us or nourish us?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the same thing that we bring to relationship, we would bring to our images of the spirit as well. And many times people, for example, could use religion in order to remain childlike, or people could go to a house of worship in order to avoid religious experience. again, it's what's it in service to inside? If someone goes to a house of worship, are they having a religious experience? Well, we don't know unless we're inside the skin of that person.
Right.
We can't say from outside that it's what anything other than what it is inside of that person. The question then is, how are our relationships being served? Do they enlarge us or diminish us? Do our images of the Spirit enlarge or diminish? I'll give you an example. I had a client once in New Jersey who said that she had sat through many an AA meeting in her own recovery process and had sort of been burned by her childhood religious experiences, so she never understood some of the God talk. And then she said, one day I was sitting in a meeting, and they were talking about the higher power, and she said, so what's the higher power in my life? And she saw an image of a bottle in front of her, a bottle of booze. And she said, suddenly, she thought, that's too small. That's too small. And she said, for the first time I realized, you know, what a higher power might be. And at that moment, that was a spiritual move. She realized that her spirit had been invested in too small a place, and it needed some larger capacity in life. And that was a spiritual shift in her life, which really began to make sense of her recovery and to move her into the place where she was supposed to go in the first place, you know, to the unfolding of her life's journey. So in every arena, there's this central question. Does this enlarge me or does it diminish me?
Right.
I think we almost always know the answer to that. We might not like the answer. We may be afraid of the answer, but we know the answer. Whether it's a career choice, a relational choice, the choice of images we're giving our energy to, does it enlarge you or diminish you? And you know.
And on that, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us today. We have been speaking with Dr. James Hollis, author of The Eden Project, In Search of the Magical Other, among other books that you can find by going to the web if you wish and looking up the publisher Inner City Books out of Toronto. I'm trying to look for their actual website, but I can't find it. But I'm sure if you did a search, you'd find that. Thank you again. It's been meaningful, and look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you
listeners,
very much. Thank
you. In May's Alternative Currents. Mm-hmm.